This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
We're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, where I'm very pleased to have an extraordinary featured guest, Germar Rudolph, who began as a student of chemistry and physics, but became involved in doing research on the history of World War II. He has actually been prosecuted for Holocaust denial and served a sentence of nearly 4 years, which I find simply dumbfounding. This is a thought crime to deny a story about World War II for which there's a mountain of evidence disproving it. I'm shocked by that, but I'm in awe and admiration of his dedication and perseverance, a man of complete and utter integrity. Germar Rudolph, welcome to The Real Deal.
Thank you for having me on your show.
I'm simply delighted, Germar, and I know you have been editing a series of Holocaust handbooks, and that we now are up to volume 38, if I'm correct, the most recent entitled Curated Lies, the Auschwitz Museum's Misrepresentations, Distortions, and Deceptions by an Italian author.
That is correct. I mean, there are a few volumes still in the middle missing that we have already set up and working on. They're just a little bit behind. But we are actually in the planning stage of volume 40 now already, so soon we will be up to 40.
That's simply excellent. I would like to believe that it had worldwide readership, and while it does, I'm sure the numbers are not really what they deserve to be, all things considered, because the official story, the official narrative of 6 million having been put to death in special chambers using Zyklon B, as you have demonstrated, is not only historically unjustified, but scientifically impossible and contradicted by the evidence. I've been very impressed by your work, Germar.
Thank you. Well, it's been a long journey. I started that series basically in the early 90s, which got me in trouble with the first work I was doing myself with forensic research on the Auschwitz camp, the claims about Auschwitz. And I wanted to make something that is catering to scholars, but also to the general readership. When it comes to Auschwitz, to the Holocaust, to all the things involved there, there's a massive amount of media propaganda and political pressure. I know from my experiences with all the work I've done, I have made an impression on a lot of historians, specialists in the field, but they wouldn't come out to say so. And we've worked with some of them together to make this series really very valuable for academics. And it's unique in the whole world. There is no such series, not even from the established side, that puts together such thorough studies about various aspects of this topic. And it keeps growing. And unfortunately, the impact is not as big as I wanted it to be, because simply the mass media keep completely silent about it, and the established scholars too stay completely mute. They don't quote any of the books, they don't quote any of the authors, even though we have produced quality research 10 times the amount that you can see on these special topics from the other side.
Yeah, I think it's simply terrific, and the fact that you've adopted a scientific approach demonstrating that the walls of chambers where Zyklon B is used will turn blue, and that the only such chambers that turned blue were those where it was being used for the purpose of delousing, that while the Germans used copious quantities of Zyklon B, it was to preserve the health of the inmates by killing body lice so they would not succeed in spreading dysentery and typhus, because after all, these were labor camps and you can't get work out of a corpse.
That's right. Or a sick inmate, for that matter.
Say again.
Or a sick inmate, for that matter.
Yes, absolutely. So they, and anyone who studies the map of Auschwitz, for example, discovers a whole host of features that would, you would not expect if these were in fact centers for extermination. There was a huge woodworking shop. There was a opera house. There was even a brothel. They had a hospital with OBGYN facilities. This is not just not what you would expect if this actually was a place where vast numbers of inmates were brought to be put to death.
Right. Now, today we want to talk about the latest book that we have released that is actually focusing on Auschwitz again. And it is titled Curated Lies, The Auschwitz Museum's Misrepresentations, Distortions, and Deceptions. And as I said, it's volume 38. The cover is displayed here on the right. I have another picture down here that shows all the volumes of the series that have appeared so far. So it's getting bigger and bigger, and it's getting more difficult to display them all in one picture because there's so many.
I think that's wonderful. Very impressive. Which are the red volumes?
The red volumes, that are fiery volumes. There are three volumes on the cremation furnaces of Auschwitz. So that's a big topic because the bottleneck of extermination is getting rid of the corpses, and that's supposed to have happened mainly with crematory ovens in Auschwitz. And there were all in all five of these crematories, and Carlo Mattonio and an Italian engineer, Franco Diana, have done a huge research effort of stretching over 20 years, get all the documentation together to research the issue of cremation technology in general and the cremation furnaces used in Auschwitz. There's one text, book of 360, 70 pages, then one just with documents showing all the original documents of some 300 pages, and another one with color photos of 200 some odd pages, I think.
And my impression is with the vast number of bodies and the amount of energy required in the limited facilities, it would have taken some 20 years to dispose of the number of bodies they claim to have cremated.
That is correct. Had the crematories lasted that long, they wouldn't have, actually.
Well, please go forward about curated lies.
Right. Yes, if I can have in the next slide here. I've divided my presentation into two sections, and the next animation shows the first section. Part one is dealing with the most important asset of the Auschwitz Museum today, and that's the only crematory that's preserved, the old crematorium in the main camp. And here I'll focus on post-war alterations that have been made by the museum and the fact that what the museum has been claiming for decades is actually filled with lies. They've changed the story recently, but it's still not honest. The second part, the next step, I will focus on a book that the Auschwitz Museum has recently published. That was 2014. Where they try to shed light on the beginnings of the claimed extermination of Jews by using the source material. And here I will actually show how they distort and misrepresent the material in their attempt to prove the orthodox narrative. Next slide. As an introduction, I'll briefly point out a video that was made in 1992 by the American Jew David Cole. He went to Auschwitz and made a documentary about what's going on there. And what is important here in this context is what he found out about Crematorium 1. You see him here in front of the, at that time, called so-called victim's entry. And I'm not going to replay the video here because it's of pretty poor quality, both the video resolution and the sound. Whoever wants to actually watch the video, there are a couple of links there. Or you can just go to YouTube and Google David Cole and Auschwitz, and it comes up. If I can have the next animation.
Tell us about it, however.
Yes.
Yes.
So he goes in there, and he points out in that video a number of features in that big room in that building that is claimed to have been a homicidal gas chambers, features that are inconsistent with the orthodox narrative. One of them is, for instance, that you can see traces of separation walls in there. That is a screenshot here from the video. It's not very clear because the resolution is so poor, but on the next animation, we see actually a high-resolution picture that I found on the Internet, and the next animation has a red arrow actually pointing to that separation wall. Can I have the next animation? There it is. There you see it. And another feature David Cole points out in the next animation is toilet drains that are in that room. There you see, again, lower resolution. If you go to the next animation, we see a higher resolution picture of it taken. You see toilet drains in there. Of course, neither separation walls dividing up that place nor the toilet drains can possibly have been a feature of a homicidal gas chamber. And as a matter of fact, it wasn't always a place, one big room, but it had been toward the end of the war an air raid shelter, that building. And in that air raid shelter, the SS had put in two toilets, and they had divided up the room in separate small rooms. That's where the separation walls came in. I forget the next animation.
Didn't Frank Lauscher do the most devastating report about the alleged gas chambers during the trial of Ernst Zundel?
Well, he was most certainly the first one who did forensic research in that area, so he was definitely a pioneer opening up. I came into the whole thing because I read his report and got enticed into doing more research about it. And he had not enough time. He was just... While the trial was already going on in 1988, I asked to quickly go to Poland and cobble together a quick report, and I didn't have time for in-depth research, and therefore it is rather superficial from what we know today, but nobody could have done a better job at that time with the little means and little time he had at his disposal.
Well, he made it quite apparent to the court at the time that these chambers could not possibly observe the function.
Right.
Homicidal gas chambers, based upon his expertise in having supervised the actual putting to death of inmates in the United States in gas chambers.
That's correct. I think David Cole himself was actually motivated originally also by Fred Luscher's report, like I was, getting involved because Fred Luscher's initial report exposed so many inconsistencies in the stories that made no sense that a lot of people started looking into it. Now, the difference between Fred Luscher and David Cole is, and I'll come to it a little later, that David Cole had a different kind of impact. And also, I want to focus here on features that are shown optically, and that's why I've chosen, because
sure.
He documented.
Of course.
Now, after he pointed out these inconsistencies, he actually had his tour guide go into that room, into that same building, and he asked her whether the building is original. You see the tour guide there, and she confirmed it is in the original state. And if you see the next animation, he went in there and asked there again, is everything original? And in particular, are the Zyklon B introduction shafts in the roof original? I'll return to those later. And she confirmed they are original. Now, that's actually the only criminal trace in that room that points to some usage of that room that cannot be explained really in any other way. If those insertion shafts were real, what were they useful for other than throwing in Zyklon B? She claims they are original. Now, David Cole was harassing her with more and more questions, so she got frustrated and got her supervisor. On the next slide, we see the supervisor in a screenshot. David Cole asked her whether those insertion holes are original, and she said, no, they are not. They were put in after the war. And he kept harassing her with more and more questions, too. And then she suggested, well, let's see Dr. Pieper, who at that time was the head of the museum archives.
Well, Germar, he wasn't really harassing, was he? He was simply asking. He was inquisitive and curious.
Yeah, well, I'm exaggerating. Yeah, that's right.
The story wasn't adding up. I mean, you know, they might call it harassment. That's putting a spin on asking a series of questions one might prefer not to answer.
Yeah, I would be glad if everyone go in there asked critical question. If people go in there with the mindset that is open, they would actually see that cannot be as it is told. There are toilet drains. There's no door in the opening between that room and the cremation hall, and there is a flimsy wooden door with a glass pane that could not lock in a hundred or hundreds of panicking people and so on. If people would think straight and ask critical question, that thing would come crashing down pretty fast, but people aren't, unfortunately. So what David Cole was doing there was something that everybody should be doing, but it was unique, and because it was unique, these tour guides were obviously uncomfortable with it.
Well, it's interesting that when the tour guide deferred to her supervisor, the supervisor was able to give an accurate answer to the question, which the tour guide was not.
Right. So in other words, the tour guide was probably improperly instructed.
My suspicion as well, that she was giving a sincere answer in a state of false belief.
That's right.
About a situation where she'd been deliberately misled.
That's correct. I don't think she was lying, but somebody else was lying to her to tell things that aren't true.
Yes, yes. To lie, you have to know the difference between the truth and what you're asserting.
Right. So on the next slide, we actually see Dr. Pieper here. David Cole managed to get an interview with him, and he was then explaining the situation. Now, I've transcribed and cleaned up his language a little bit since he's Polish and his English is not good. We get the next animation. We see what he said about those alterations that were done to the building. Can I get the next step?
Jens, I think you just
not doing.
Slide. Just hit the next slide, the slide button.
No, not clicking. It's just next animation. The left arrow or the right arrow goes forward. Yes.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay. So he said in 1944, in connection with the bombardment of Auschwitz by Allied air forces, the empty crematorium one, that's the one we're talking about, and the gas chamber in it, were adapted as an air raid shelter. At that time, additional walls were built inside the former gas chamber, and an additional entrance was made from the east side of the gas chamber. And the openings in the ceiling, through which gas Cyclone B was discharged, were at that time liquidated. So after the liberation of the camp, the former gas chamber presented the view of an air raid shelter. In order to regain the earlier view, the earlier appearance of this object, the inside walls built in 44 were removed, and the openings in the ceiling were made anew. So now this gas chamber is very similar to this one as it existed in 1941-42. Not all details were made there, so there is no gas-tight doors, for instance. The additional entrance from the east side remained as it was made in 44. Such were the changes made after the war in order to regain the earlier appearance of the object.
Kermar, this is transparent fiction. This is a completely ridiculous story. To serve it as an apology for the obvious features that are inconsistent with a homicidal gas chamber. This is a lie.
Well, yeah, we come to that to actually reveal that it is a lie. I mean, you believe it's a lie, but it's always a different issue to prove it. Now, let's prove it. Go to the next animation with the right arrow. And actually, Cole asked then, well, were the holes put in exactly the same place as they were before? Because the issue is there aren't any other traces in the ceiling that could be explained as other holes. So either there never were any before, or they must have put in the ones we see today in the same place. And Dr. Pieper answered that in the affirmative, next step please, by saying, yes, in the same place because the traces were visible on the ceiling. And that is either he believes it or he lies. I don't know.
Now, this is also embarrassing, Germar. Embarrassing.
Right. But we can prove it. We go to the next one.
I'm with you. You're absolutely correct, though. I mean, discerning something is a lie and proving it piece by piece are two different matters, and I admire what you're doing.
Yes. So very briefly, the Cole video stopped there, unfortunately. Could have gone farther to actually expose people that he has been lying. Now, the Cole video had a huge impact because Cole was a Jew, or is a Jew, I should say, and people are unfortunately more inclined to believe a Jew who says something in this matter than a Gentile.
It's more difficult to dismiss it as anti-Semitism.
That's right. And, of course, he exposed to a broader audience with visual means that the Auschwitz Museum has been telling lies to the tourists by means of not instructing their tour guides properly. So on the next animation step, we see that I have here three steps of the next step, please, of the repercussions. First of all, he was invited to national TV. He appeared on 60 Minutes in 92 and then the Phil Donahoe show in 94. Links given down there. You can see the entire show. So I don't want to focus on that. Next step.
Yeah, but Germar, I have questions about this. Could we go back a slide, please? We zip by very, very fast. Yeah, this.
Yeah,
so
just
what we have here is, this is the cover of a videotape that he put together.
That's right. That's the videotape I was just talking about as it was published.
VHS, I guess.
That was VHS, right? And down there you have one in a different language. So it appeared in many languages all over the world, and they sold many thousands and thousands of copies. And it has still a lot of views now on YouTube. There are many copies on YouTube, and people are still impressed by it.
Very good, very good, very good. Okay. So he made important contribution. He made inroads into the study of whether or not there were homicidal gas chambers at Auschwitz.
They opened people's. He opened people's mind to allowing doubts.
Yes.
And that is very important because it's the very first step to actually looking deeper into it and seeing whether something is true or not. And that actually. His video had an impact. Mainstream media started talking about the dishonesty. If we see in the next step, I have an example of talking about the dishonesty.
Well, Phil Donahue, you know, is a very interesting fellow. He had one of the few bona fidely liberal programs on television. And at the time of the 9/11 wars, Donahue was raising questions, and they took him off the air as a consequence. So he couldn't be a thorn in the side to the Bush-Cheney administration. It's quite deplorable, but predictable if you understand the close relationship between the major media and the government here in the United States.
Correct, unfortunately. So one of the most quoted articles that appeared a little afterwards is by a French Jew, Eric Conan, who admitted in a major article in a French weekly that everything in that alleged gas chamber at Auschwitz is false, is misrepresented. And he said that things like that are being used by deniers. And he referred indirectly to the Cole video for their evil intentions. So then a year later, there was a book that was talking about it by a Dutch, next animation step, by a Dutch historian who said that the crematorium was reconstructed in a false way to assert the alleged extermination as it happened in a different part of the camp, which is completely obliterated to the, or almost completely, the Birkenau camp. So, and nothing explains these reconstructions, and the guides remain silent about it. So that was along the same line of what David Cole had.
It's interesting to me that this was published by Yale University Press.
Oh, yeah.
Yale seems to have a long history of association with the CIA. I've been very troubled by that. And it's impressive to me that they would publish a work that would be exposing the truth about the Holocaust.
Well, they didn't. That's the only critical parts you see in the whole book. I mean, the book mainly focuses on the history of the town of Auschwitz, the Auschwitz concentration camp, the history of that is only a minor part in that book. And there are only a few lines critical to the way the museum represents the exhibit there.
That's consistent there. With my interpretation of the role of the institution.
Yeah, well, Robert von Pell, we'll encounter him later. He became one of the big shots of mainstream Holocaust historiography. He was an expert witness in the David Irving trial in 2000, where he contributed to David Irving's defeat. So next animation.
So you're saying Robert Van Pelt became a spokesman for the official narrative of the
He's war. Always been. He's always been.
He's always been.
Yeah, a Dutch Jew and is very outspoken about his allegiances in this regard. So the old story we have here composite image number one depicts what was called until the early 2000s, the so-called entrance of the victims. However, that is the entry that was added, as Dr. Pieper said, only in 1944 when the place was converted into an air raid shelter. That wasn't existent at the time when it's supposed to have served as a homicidal gas chamber. Number two is a sign. I don't have a close-up here from it, but it basically says to tourists, this is the victim's entry. And number three are the gallows where Camp Commandant Hirst was hanged after his trial after the war. So next animation shows...
Do you believe, by the way, that he deserved to be hung?
I'm against the death penalty under any circumstances because you can't revise it. There are always new evidence. There's always a possibility to have new evidence showing that somebody's innocent or not quite as guilty as it was thought, and you can't revise a death sentence. Therefore, I'm opposed to it in general. Running a camp where people are incarcerated by the hundreds of thousands that have not committed a crime just because they belong to a member of a certain group is a legal issue that would lead us too far astray. I'm not agreeing with that.
Would I be correct to infer that this was a political trial?
Oh, yeah. In 1946-47 in Poland, anything on trial against Germany was a historical and a political trial. It was a Stalinist country at that time that was most certainly a short trial. That's a different issue to whether or not the commandants of German concentration camps deserved punishment. I mean, the German SS had court-martialed some of them for transgressions, and they had punished them, some even executed them. So it's not beyond possibility that some of them deserved harsh punishment.
Yes.
But that's a different issue. So the situation as it presents itself today, after all the criticism that was triggered by the Cole video, finally the Auschwitz Museum owned up to the mess they've made, and they put up a nice sign where they juxtapose on the left the situation as it's claimed to have been in 1942 when the place is said to have been used or abused as a homicidal gas chamber, and on the right side, the reconstruction that was done in 1946-47, and as it pretty much looks today, I've put a blue square around the letter C. That is the room. It's said to have been a homicidal gas chamber. It says in the legend too. Now, if we go to the first animation, there comes a red arrow at the top. That is the entrance that was added when the place was converted into an air raid shelter in 1944, and that for many decades.
According to the account.
Yeah, well there's a lot of documentation. There is no doubt about that. Was added later. There's blueprints in the original German documentation for that. So that was added in 1944.
But it wasn't a homicidal gas chamber to begin with.
Right. We come to that. We'll prove that. Good. Yeah. So. So that was claimed wrongly to have been the victim's entry, which was wrong. Now they admit it. On the left side, we see it wasn't there in 1942. No entry directly into that room. You would have come to from the bottom, actually, where the museum had put the little white arrow. Then the second animation shows a major screw up they did when they quote unquote reconstructed the place. Second animation side shows another arrow pointing to a dotted line. Where's our animator?
Next button, Chance. Yeah.
Okay. There's the dotted line. If we compare it with the left-hand picture, there is a wall that has been removed that shouldn't have been removed. That wasn't part of room C. That is the original morgue. And then when it was converted to an air raid shelter, they walled up the connection, the door between the morgue and the furnace hall. And when they quote-unquote reconstructed it, they reopened it. The third red arrow points at it. But they reopened it at the wrong place. And it's just there's no door in it today. It's just a big gap in the wall that they put in there. Now, that's the situation as it is today. There's nothing on there. On the right side, we see actually the victim's entry, as it was called before. Today is chained off, and they have actually for tourists a sign that said no entrance. You're not even allowed to go in there anymore. Until the early 2000s, everybody was herded right through there. Nowadays, it's chained off. About the Cyclone B introduction shafts, there's nothing said on that side, nothing on the sign we see here, but on the right side, you can see parts of another big sign that put up there. It's just an explanation on it, and it has two short phrases on it. The next animation shows the first one. It's the claim that the museum makes about those insertion shafts when it was converted to an air raid shelter. Next one. Next step, please. So, no, that was one too much. Go one back, please. Left arrow. Okay. So it says there, the holes in the roof through which the ESS had poured Zyklon B were sealed at the time when the place was converted into an air raid shelter. You can't have really an air raid shelter with holes in the roof. That doesn't work. So they claim they were sealed up. And on the next slide, we see then the second phrase that the museum has on that side. And it said, after the war, the museum partially reconstructed the gas chamber and crematorium. The chimney and two incinerators were rebuilt using original components, as were several of the openings in the gas chamber roof. Now, they don't say they were actually put in the exact spots they were before, but it's tacitly assumed. The next animation has red arrows pointing to those interaction shafts as we see them today in that big image on the left. Next step, there they are, four of them. And we'll focus now on these in the next slide. Next animation. There is actually one picture that from seen from the inside, one of those four. That's the way they look like. So crudely hacked through the ceiling with wooden boards around it. And the museum today says, yeah, we did that in 1947, basically. On the next slide.
Now, Gurmar, let me ask, was the Zyklon B supposed to be inserted in tablets? I mean, I've seen the device that was supposed to produce the gas out of the Zyklon B tablets. Or what? I mean, wood wouldn't be suitable for an actual gas to be introduced.
The Zyklon B is the trade name for a product that consists of a carrier material, which is gypsum soaked with liquid hydrogen cyanide, and that's the toxic component we're talking about. So these are gypsum granules, the size of pea size, I would say, and that comes in did come in cans. You can actually get it still today, but it's on a different name.
But if you just pour it out, would it dissolve and turn into gas?
Yeah, it evaporates. It evaporates. Hydrogen cyanide has a very low boiling point, so it evaporates rather quickly, but it still takes some time. Now, they had special devices in those years to actually make the evaporation process go quickly and to dissipate it around the room when they wanted to do professional delousing. And you would expect, had they intended to do mass murder in a quick time, industrial conveyor belt style, they would have used this kind of technique. They did not. Their claim is here. They just hacked holes through the heating and ceiling and threw the stuff through there. Now, that's a primitive claim, but that's the author of the narrative as it is. Now, the question is, they ask here on the next slide, how do they know that they actually put those holes in the spots that were visible before? Dr. Pieper, if you go to the next step, Dr. Pieper can't possibly know because at war's end, he's born in 1941, so he was a little boy. He couldn't know personally from personal experiment. So the question is there any documentation? He had actually a friend ask a reputable professor to approach the Auschwitz Museum, write him a letter asking, did the Soviets or Polish authorities document or photograph the interior of the crematorium before any alterations were done? And the second question on the next animation that was asked to the Auschwitz Museum is there any documentation about the actual changes made after the war, like protocols, cost estimates, blueprints, work orders, and so forth? Next step.
You would think, of course, if there had been such alterations, there would be such plans, there would be such blueprints, there would be such documents.
Here's the response. Let's focus on the response first and go then on the implication of the whole story. The next step, we can actually see it, that's enlarged there. In response to your letter, I would like to inform you that unfortunately we cannot help you. Our museum does not have any documents on the matters that interest you. From the memories of former employees, we know that the work on the reconstruction work was done in the second half of 1947. That's the answer we got. So in other words, there's nothing.
Totally useless.
Totally useless. Next slide. Next slide, please. So we got back. Okay, if they have testimonies from witnesses, what is it? Can they send us copies of it? They did. It's one guy only, apparently, that has testified to this effect. A certain Adam Sobinitsky, who has been an inmate in the camp and who later on served for a while as a guard for the early time of the museum. And he made a statement. It's in Polish on the left side, and I have it translated here. I remember exactly that the introduction holes for Zyklon B gas, which used to be in the roof of the crematorium, were also reconstructed. The task of those charged with this reconstruction was facilitated by the fact that distinct traces of the cement patches of the early openings were left in spots of the old introduction holes. Hence, new openings were broken through at the same spots and little chimneys were built with bricks. This work was also done in the years 46-47. Now, first of all, that thing was done 35 years after the war. Secondly, it is by a bystander. It's not by somebody that was involved in actually organizing the reconstruction. He was not a member of the administration. He was not a member of the work team of the companies that did that. It was just a guard that was doing his guard duties somewhere else. How is he supposed to know these details?
They needed somebody to say this, Gerbart.
So they didn't find any better. I'm dumbfounded that they didn't find anyone else. And the problem in the account itself is he says there, the Polish word domurowano means built with, built walled up, built with bricks. The shafts actually, as we have seen, are made of wooden boards. It doesn't even fit. So.
Yes, I love it.
Next slide.
Cannot be true.
Right. Well, whatever he has that knowledge from, 35 years later, he must have heard it and put it in there. Now we come to the core of the legal issue involved here. These claimed traces in the ceiling that they claim to have seen at war's end and then reopened were prime evidence for a mass crime committed. If those shafts existed, that is prime evidence that the Germans did something evil there. So documenting the original situation as it was when the camp was liberated and the Poles and the Soviet authorities moved in there would have been most important. But what did they do? Did they secure the evidence? No, they destroyed it. They said, well, there were traces, but we destroyed it by hacking in through new holes. So what does it mean when somebody destroys the only real evidence we have, the only material evidence? And I've looked up Wikipedia. It says it very clearly. Next animation step, I underline it red. Please. Your right arrow key. Here, the spoliation of evidence is the intentional, reckless, or negligent withholding, hiding, altering, fabricating, or destroying of evidence relevant to legal proceedings. There were two big trials going on at that time against Commandant Hirsch and the staff of Auschwitz, show trials that were casting in stone the official narrative about Auschwitz being an extermination camp. And those traces in the ceiling would have been prime evidence, but they didn't secure it. They actually destroyed it. This destruction, next step, please. This destruction of evidence is in almost all countries either criminal by statute, next arrow, or it is criminal by case law. So what the Auschwitz Museum authorities did in their early years, next step, please, was committing a crime by messing with the evidence, by destroying the evidence. Next right key, please. Where's the guy with the right hand key?
Yes.
Right arrow, please.
Yes. We got you there.
Okay, see. Yeah, so we went too much.
Go back.
One step back. The left arrow key. Okay. So the theory of spoliation inference is that when a party destroys evidence, it may be reasonable that the party had consciousness of guilt or other motivation to avoid, or in that case, destroy the evidence. Therefore, the fact finder may conclude that the evidence would have been unfavorable to the spoliator. In other words, the only reason to destroy and not document what you have done is that what you claim is not true. There were no
consciousness of guilt is a very important concept here.
So, next slide. We have them there legally, normally in an independent court. That would be enough to sentence them for fraud and spoliation of evidence. Now let's look at blueprints where we actually use the location of the introduction shafts as they are today. Then we get an indication, another circumstantial evidence that points at who is lying here and what the truth is. Here is shown the walls as they were at the time when the place is said to have served as a homicidal gas chamber. As a matter of fact, all the blueprints say it was just a morgue. The dark gray is the ceiling. The holes in there are the four introduction shafts as they exist today. You can see already the distribution in that long room that is supposed to have been the morgue, the gas chamber. It doesn't make much sense. Now, if we go to the next animation step.
Well, the complex design of this chamber makes it very difficult to see how they get the bodies out, Germar. I mean, it's just making a mess. This is a little tiny maze. I don't see any way it could possibly have served the function that is being attributed to it. But removing the bodies here, these doorways and all that, is ridiculous.
Yeah, this situation is the second one, and I saw it's in 1944. This crematorium was decommissioned in 1943 when the big crematories in Birkenau went operational, and so this was retired in 1944 when Allied air forces from Italy could bombard East Germany. They start building air raid shelters there. So since the building wasn't used anymore, they converted this part into an air raid shelter of several separate rooms with additional walls to support the structure in case it gets hit. These are the additional walls, and you see now here next animation step points the blue arrow points to the victim entry / entry to the air raid shelter. Red arrow, please. Right arrow.
It's sticking a bit. I think. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, there you have the additional separation walls, and one step further, you see additional entrance that was added here on the right side. Okay, next step.
Right arrow key caps, yeah.
Is his keyboard not working?
Well, it was slow.
All right. That is the situation as it is today. Since 47 and still is today. So they knocked down the separation walls. If we have the next animation step, the arrows point at where they used to be and where nowadays still traces in the wall and on the floor can be seen. That is the entrance they didn't remove but should have removed, was claimed for a long time as the victim's entry, but it is, of course, it has not been because it didn't exist back then. Next step. Okay, these were the separation walls were, but they're no longer. Next step. Okay, I switch between the situation of 42 with the LH gas chamber and how it is today to make clear what the difference is. So next step shows the next slide. And that's where we get to the truth. This shows the situation as it is, and it shows distances along the long side of the room between the insertion holes and opposite walls. And that shows that these insertion holes were pretty much exactly put in to be kind of symmetrical and equidistant to opposing walls. So you see there very strong evidence they designed the holes to make sense, to have an equal distribution in that new room, in that room that is too long because they knocked down one wall too much. Next step.
You know, the whole contrivance was done with great forethought.
Right. They didn't know that they messed up by putting one wall, knocking one wall out, and then they put the holes in considering the total size of the new room, which was too big. But that now is strong circumstance to the evidence that these holes have nothing to do with an original state of 42. Okay, very good. We go to the next slide. Now the question is, can it be... is it conceivable that the Auschwitz Museum in those years committed that kind of a forgery? And the answer to that is yes, because we have a precedent that has been admitted by now, and that's the Majdanek camp. We're looking here at a picture of a room that officially was a morgue, but has been for decades claimed to have been a homicidal gas chamber in what is called the new crematory in that camp. What you're looking at here is the yellow circle at the top, a hole in the ceiling knocked out, which is said to have been used again to dump in Zyklon B. Strangely enough, exactly over the drain and the floor. So if you put granules through that, they would end up in that drain. It's not good design. However, next animation step.
Oh, needless to add, Germar, none of these walls are blue, which would have they would have turned blue from interaction with the Zyklon B had they actually been used for that purpose, as you yourself
No, we don't even have to go to the sophistication of chemical forensic. Actually, in the next step, I point at a feature that actually clearly shows that is a hole in the wall that has no window. Yes. It's open, so you can't seal that room. Had you thrown in poison gas in there, they would have set the whole building under gas. You also, the hole in the ceiling you couldn't close up. It's just knocked out. Also, the whole attic and from there on the whole building would have been set under gas. This room has no ventilation system, so you couldn't remove the gas other than by pushing it out into the other rooms. And this is a complete, it's impossible, technically completely impossible to use that place as anything else than storing stuff. If it is
they didn't know exactly what they were doing and botched it pretty badly.
Yeah, they approached it so pretty badly that they had to backtrack eventually. Now, this is not the only case. The next animation shows another picture of a similar hole, same camp, however, no, that's actually a close-up of that hole that we're seeing there. You can see the woodwork of the attic up there, of the roof. So you see how crudely that's been hacked through. The reinforcement bars are still in there. That's the kind of craftsmanship.
That's ridiculous, Nirmal.
Yeah, it's suicidal. Totally, if anyone had fraudulent. Used that, they'd kill someone, they would have killed themselves.
Totally fraudulent. How ridiculous is that?
Absolutely, that's my dynamic. And there are two more. Next animation, there's a different building that was used actually as a delousing facility. They messed with that too and hacked through in that ceiling. Two holes that you see one here again, crudely done with reinforcement bars in it. On the next animation, it's another room in the same building, the delousing facility. Same thing, crudely hacked through, reinforcement bars in there. Now, all these obvious frauds and impossibilities have been exposed next animation step by a revisionist study that was first published in 98 in German, but 7 years later, or no, actually 6 years later, also in English, by, again, Carlo Martoni, whose book we are talking about here too, and Jürgen Graf, Concentration Camp Majdanek. This study put the Majdanek authorities under so much pressure that with the next animation step, 7 years later, the head of the Majdanek Museum published an article where he backtracked massively and discarded 5 of the 7 claimed homicidal gas chambers in Majdanek and discarded all the claims about Zyklon B murder and pretty much indirectly admitted that all these rooms, all these whole forgeries, whole hoaxes we see here are exactly what they are. By decommissioning, in the back here you see a sign that still says, this room was used as a homicide gas chamber, but today you won't see that sign anymore. It is not claimed anywhere anymore that any of these rooms were used to kill with Zyklon B because they had to admit it's...
They look to me like underground storage facilities, Nirmal.
Well, that's less room in the middle. It was probably a morgue where they just stored corpses before they cremated.
Okay.
So, this indirect admission proves that that they were capable, absolutely capable, because they did it before to commit such a forgery. Now, there's another issue I want to quickly point out, and that is revealing doors. Here is shown a blueprint of the Auschwitz crematorium, going back to that camp. The old Auschwitz crematorium, as it was in 1940. And you see there the door that connects the morgue at the bottom. Jim says the Leichenraum is corpse room to the oven room, the oven room, the furnace hall at the top. And next animation actually gets this enlarged. This is a door that swings right through. This is a swinging door. So if you imagine you carry some heavy corpses, you don't have your hands free to operate a door handle. It's like in a restaurant. If you have your hands full with tablets, you have a swinging door, you push your way through, and it works for both ways. And that's the smart design for a situation like that. Now, if you want to use that room as a gas chamber, you have to have a door that is heavy metal, gas tight, and secure against a panicking crowd. You can't use a swinging door. That's never going to work. Now, we have a blueprint of the situation as it was in April 1942 in the next slide. And it shows the same door. They haven't changed it. That is right squat in the middle of when it's supposed to have been used as a homicidal gas chamber. And they still have a swinging door in there. That cannot possibly have been a homicidal gas chamber. The next animation again enlarged it to make it more clear. Same door. This was not a homicidal gas chamber. It cannot have been. As a matter of fact, there's another document from 1944 when they were about to convert it into an air raid shelter, and they still had the swinging door in there. They never removed it. There were no gas-tight doors in, as Dr. Pieper says. There's no trace in the documents that we have, anywhere in the blueprints, no gas-tight doors were ever built in until it was converted into an air raid shelter in 1944. Then they put airtight doors in it to protect themselves in case of gas attacks by Allied bomber fleets. So next animation. That pretty much seals the fate of that gas chamber.
Yes.
That's the end of it.
Yes.
So that was how millions of visitors are being duped, led through that gas chamber every, quote unquote, gas chamber, I should say, every year. 1.5 million visitors go to Auschwitz every year and get their dose of lying, fraudulent hoax propaganda by being told lies about that room. If you know the documents, you can refute it, but the visitors won't know. Now to the second part, the documents. That is more what concerns the scholars in the field. And if we go to the next step of the animation, the majority of archival material about Auschwitz survived the war. There's always claims floating around that the Germans destroyed the evidence of their crimes, and that's not true. Regarding Auschwitz, almost all of it has survived the war and is still available. Next step. We can go through those paragraphs rather quickly. So most important material here are the files of the Central Construction Office that was in charge of maintaining and building all these buildings there that are of interest here. Next step. And these materials became accessible when the Soviet Union collapsed to at the end, the early 1990s. Next step. Because they had been hidden in Moscow. The Red Army, when they moved into Auschwitz, they took the files and ran.
Next step. Describing them as hidden implies they were deliberately obscured from access, and that's what you mean to imply, that the Soviets didn't want the information out that they had.
Yes. Matanyo and Jürgen Graf and other people, revisionists, got access to it in the mid-90s and actually spoke with the employees at the archives, and they were talking about the contents. Now in the Soviet Union in the early 90s, mid-90s, there was a wind of perestroika blowing through these archives even, and the archivists there clearly stated that there is no trace in the documentation of any homicidal activities, and what they have seen actually refutes it, and that's the reason why they are hiding it. Now the Auschwitz Museum obtained a microfilm copy of it around the same time. And unfortunately, with the next step, they have produced very little since. And what we'll be discussing next slide, please, is what they actually have produced based on that material. Next slide. Okay, there's the cover of that book. And on the right, we can see the lead author, who is also the current head of the Auschwitz Museum, the successor of Dr. Pieper, that's Dr. Setkiewicz. And next slide. The next step shows the table of contents, and we see here it's bilingual.
These are the custodians of the myth.
Right. Curators of the myth.
Yes.
That's what the Matanya's book is about, curated lies. You see, it has an introduction of 16 pages, next step of the animation, and then it has actually very brief comments on the document reproductions they do and of the 74 documents. And if we go to the next slide, it shows a little bit how that book looks like. Next animation. So the bilingual, very brief comments and summary, and that's all that this book is about. And considering that they had 20 years to evaluate the material and could have come up with a vast, rewritten, accurate history of Auschwitz, that this is basically what they throw at us, it's an insult. Next,
well, it's clear that it's intended to perpetrate the mythology. I mean,
right. And it's difficult.
And this is not a research effort. This is propaganda.
That's right. They're trying to cover the truth. So all in all, if you summarize, there are 35 pages of text in that book, and that's it. Next step. First sentence in that book's next step, I highlight it here and magnify it. For many years, the beginnings of the extermination of the Jews in gas chambers has been one of the least researched issue in the extensive literature on the history of Auschwitz. Numerous monumental works by historians devote only a few pages to the question. Next step shows the footnote, and there are three works in there. One of it is actually a major work, five-volume work, published by the Auschwitz Museum, five volumes, but still they have made very little use of the archival material found in Moscow, and only a brief section there on one subtopic of what we're dealing with here. Then a book by Presak was published before the material in Moscow became accessible and is as such irrelevant. And here you see Robert von Pelt. We encountered him before, The Case of Four Auschwitz. That's his book version of the expert report he gave at the during the Irving trial in 2000. That's a rather superficial book because Van Pelt is not a Holocaust historian and didn't really have access to that archival material and doesn't use it at all.
But isn't it exactly the opposite, that this is one of the most researched issues?
This is exactly the issue. Let's go to the next slide. First sentence. First lie. Next step. Next step, please. Next step. Okay. That is indeed a lie. Three monographs on the claimed early history of homicidal gassings at Auschwitz have been published by Carlo Mottogno. Next step, we can go through the next three steps really quickly. There are three steps to the early history. The first one is the claimed first gassing, which is said to have happened in September 1941. Next step, please. Now, there they all three. So here are the three monographs that Carlo Mottogno has published. The earliest came out in 92. In English language, they have been available now for all of them for 10 years or more. And they are the only monographs on these topics. You find only short sentences, paragraphs, or a few pages in the established literature on these problems. But Carlo Mottogno, based on all this material he got from Moscow and other archives, has written extensive monographs. And they are completely silent about it. Next step, please. So claiming that nothing has been published about it really, and there are only a few pages, is just a lie, because they are silent about the only real deep, thorough research that exists on that topic. Next step. So, there were two separate ones. So Carlo Mottogno has written 450 pages on that topic, whereas the book of these Auschwitz historians has only 35 pages of text. So he has done 10 times more than they have done, and yet they're completely silent about it. Then you go to the second page, and you have two more lies, the first of which, next step, claims, next step, that the documents they are presenting here in this book is new and unknown. Next step, which is a lie, because almost half of the documents that are presented in that book have been, next step, have been published by Carlo Mottogno before, or have been mentioned in footnotes by him and have been discussed, or have even already been published by Jean-Claude Pressac. Go through the next steps quickly, please. Here they are. So 9 by Carlo Mottogno reproduced, 19 more discussed, Jean-Claude Pressac already. In the late 90s, had 3 of them published.
Is this a good time to take our break, Germar, or would you like to do at least one more slide?
One more slide, if possible. Perfect. Then we have the second lie that's in there covered, and we can actually go to the documents themselves. Next step, magnify that. What they are claiming here on the in another paragraph, next step, I highlighted that these documents hardly ever refer directly to killings in the gas chamber. Next step. Do not usually refer directly to killings. That's
they
another line.
They virtually never do. I mean, maybe
not virtually.
Don't.
Not virtually. They never do. Next up, none
I
of these.
Say they don't usually refer as a euphemism.
Not even that. There's nothing in them that could be interpreted as criminal or sinister. Nothing. Next step. So documents actually contradict witness statements, which they adduce here to say, well, you can understand that only if you use witness statements to understand the documents. Actually, the documents contradict the witness statements. And familiarity with the other documents refutes homicidal claims. And they say, in a sense, well, you have to put it in the context of other documents to understand them. If you really do, then you figure out there's nothing homicidal in them. And last but not least, next up, if you want to insinuate any criminal or sinister contents in them, finding homicidal intent requires either unfamiliarity with the documents or mendacity about their contents and context. Now, that's a bold claim. And after the break, I guess that we come to the part where I actually step by step prove it by showing how they distort, lie, mistranslate, take out of context and are absolutely mendacious about these issues.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my very special guest, Germar Rudolph, talking about the latest contribution to a series of volumes about the end of World War II, especially related to the Holocaust and claims related to the use of homicidal gas chambers at Auschwitz. We'll be right back.
Moonrock Books. We're a group of scholars, experts, and authors who feel the world really needs saving and that resisting the American Empire is the right thing to do. People are starved for truth. They are given lies. They subsist on lies, but it's not really living. People are not watching TV news. They're ceasing to read newspapers, too, because they know by now they will not find it there. The biggest battle being fought anywhere is with information. If the people can receive the truth, they will do the right thing. We are publishing the truth about Sandy Hook, about the Boston bombing, about the moon landings, about the Holocaust, and much, much more. The truth. It falls upon us to fight the Empire and save the world. Join us, Moonrock Books.
Hi, my name's Gary King, and I've assembled the most formidable JFK team on planet Earth. We've got Dr. James Fetzer, Larry Rivera, who is the number one researcher in the world today when it comes to new research. And we've got Don Fox, who's not afraid to look a little bit deeper than anyone else. So if you're interested in what happened to the 35th President of the United States, then I invite you to our show. It's called The New JFK Show, and it's on YouTube. Go to Gary King YouTube channel. And we've got over 90 shows archived for you there. So if you really want to know the truth, and knowing that over 9 out of 10 researchers are working the other side of the street in a sea of disinformation, I pledge to you the truth about JFK. Go to Gary King YouTube channel and find out your true history.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, continuing my conversation with Germar Rudolph about the existence or not of homicidal gas chambers at Auschwitz, the subject of a new book, a volume in a series dedicated to the study of the history of World War II related to the Holocaust. Germar.
Right. So proving the bold claim that they are lying and misrepresenting the contents of the archives is my next step. And I want to start with a pervasive lie that not only the Auschwitz Museum is perpetrating, but the whole field of Holocaust study is filled with it. And that is the claim that there is only one Sonderkommando. The Orthodox claim is the so-called Sonderkommando, which translates to special unit, was a unit of inmates, almost all of them Jews. Next step. And they were in charge of three things that are listed next. Dragging corpses out of the gas chamber. And I have here an image to the right showing how that's supposed to have happened by an inmate that survived the war. David O'Leary, who was a painter and who drew that scene there. Extracting the goat teeth from the murdered victims, cutting off long hair for recycling, and next step.
This is very much at the core of the whole official narrative right there, Germar. I mean, look at the massive, heavy door they're showing and dragging the bodies and all that. I was suggesting it was a ridiculous arrangement for that purpose.
Yes, and cremating corpses in furnaces on pyres, and he has drawn another picture here. Now, these pictures are not historically accurate. For instance, the ovens there, they are only, the doors are only half the size as he has drawn them there. And the elevator that was used to get corpses up in the background was extremely small, could only hold a few corpses. So these drawings are already lies in and of themselves, but I don't want to focus on that yet. I'm just trying to get across what the Orthodox claim is.
Sure.
And the next step, what I already said, they claim that was the only type of Sonderkommando that existed. So when they ever encounter, on the next step, encounter the term Sonderkommando in any document, they by force connect it with homicidal activities. Even though a document may be completely innocuous, talking about something that a Sonderkommando was involved, for them it's clear that since there was only one, that is another proof for homicidal activities. Next slide. And that is a lie. And they know it, and they're hiding it from all of us, from you, anyone who would read this book and similar one, because already in 2000 there was a monograph published again by Carlo Martogno on special treatment. It appeared in 4 years later in English, but the next step is the biographic information for the Italian edition, which it appeared four years earlier. And in that book, and the next step, at least
this was actually a thesis, I take it.
Well, everything he writes is kind of the depth and the intensity. And
no, I meant, was it submitted for a degree?
No, okay. You have to find a university that would accept controversial papers like that.
Understood.
Yes, unfortunately. He is due for at least 10 honorable doctorate degrees and should have university and teach people.
Very good, yeah.
And I'd like to do the same thing, but they wouldn't let me either. So he proves in there. He has gone through all this Moscow documentation, found all these huge amounts of documents talking about these terms that mainstream historiography said point to homicidal intent. Terms like special treatment, special operation, special unit, special measure, they're all listed here if it advances fast enough. And he shows that terms nowhere have any homicidal context in the documents of Auschwitz. One of these pages in his books, or two actually, lists a number of Sonderkommandos that have nothing to do with the next step. I have it actually transcribed so that it can be read a little bit better. That have nothing to do with homicidal intent. There is a Sonderkommando that has to do with pest control, made up of women. One that is assigned to sorting clothes. And there are a number of special units that are just assigned to certain works in certain areas in the camp or outside the camp. And there is actually, at the end of the list, to a Sonderkommando Zeppelin. And all these Sonderkommandos he has found, and he has found not a single one that has anything to do with homicidal activities. All these he has found have nothing to do. They are completely with homicidal activities. They're completely innocuous. The Sonderkommando Zeppelin leads us to the next slide. The Sonderkommando was actually a term that was used by the SS organization, which didn't just run the concentration camps, but a lot of other things in wartime Germany, in many contexts. And Thomas Kuhs and other revisionist researchers did a study analyzing a lot of primary literature documents and so on, trying to find Sonderkommandos where they are mentioned. And on the next animation, I have the list that he had published in that paper that shows Sonderkommandos of the SS that are not connected with Auschwitz. The first one is the Zeppelin Sonderkommando, again, that was located outside of Auschwitz, which appears sometimes in the context of Auschwitz for reasons not quite understood. Anyway, these are different Sonderkommandos with special tasks because of the German prefix Sonder just means special. There's nothing sinister about that word. And some of them, these Sonderkommandos were involved in killing like anti-partisan unit. They were involved in killing partisans when they fought them at a time when partisans were still killed at the beginning of the war. Later on, they didn't do that anymore. So you see two lists of Sonderkommandos that had nothing to do whatsoever with homicidal activities in Auschwitz. The Auschwitz camp was buzzing with Sonderkommandos. The SS organization was buzzing with Sonderkommandos all over Germany and the territories they had occupied or were allied with. Next slide, please. And while going through the documentation again that the was published now by the Auschwitz Museum and made Karl Matonje go again through his material. He found two more. The first one is a Sonderkommando that actually was in charge of pulling gold teeth out of corpses. That did indeed exist. It turns out that the dental station in Auschwitz had a Sonderkommando that needed to remove metal alloys and dentures from corpses. People who had died in Auschwitz. A lot of people died in Auschwitz, there's no doubt about it. And you can't cremate people that have metal parts in them or else your cremation model gets messed up. So you have to remove them. What you do with them then is another thing. And then he found also in the documentation a Sonderkommando that worked at the railway ramp at Auschwitz when these huge prisoner transports came into the camp. Their property was taken over. It had to be removed, cleaned, disinfested, and stored. And each time a train came, this special unit was assembled, sent to the ramp, and did that. And during the big Auschwitz trial in the mid-60s, there were a number of witnesses who testified to it. The first two listed here are defendants. The next four are witnesses for the prosecution, former inmates. And they all said, well, the Sonderkommando we know about is the one that sorted the stuff at the railway ramp. Caused a little bit of confusion with the judges who also thought Sonderkommando must have been the one that was involved in killing operations, but no. So there are even more of these. You see here actually two pictures. One shows a situation in Auschwitz where inmates dump clothes that new inmates coming into the camp has brought along and they needed to be sorted, be cleaned. There's another one shows one of the storage huts. The SS has documented what they were doing. There are a lot of pictures on the internet if you just look for it, showing the vast amount of inmate property that was cleaned and taken care of. And a lot of these Sonderkommandos were about that. But in all this vast documentation, there is not a single trace of a homicidal Sonderkommando. Now the next step. Actually, documents dealing with the staff employed at the Auschwitz crematoria, the ones that are supposed to have been the Sonderkommando dragging out the corpses and burning them, is never referred to in the documents as Sonderkommando. They are just staff of the crematorium or they have a certain number assigned. And there's only one document known that has the term Sonderkommando in context of a crematorium. You see it here. Next animation enlarges it and has the buzzwords underlined. That is written by some guard who reports about an escape attempt of inmates. And he says that around 2 p.m. today, a large number of prisoners escaped from the concentration camp Auschwitz II, which is Birkenau, from the Sonderkommando in parenthesis crematorium, mostly Jews. Some of the fugitives have already been shot during the initiated pursuit. The search operation continues. So that's the harsh reality. If you, during the war, try to break out of any kind of camp, you're at risk of being shot.
So you regard that as an authentic document, Germar?
I have no problems with it because that person had no idea of what these particular people were called, what their unit was called. Since the place was buzzing with Sonderkommando and almost every second unit of inmates was called Sonderkommando this, Sonderkommando that, why should the guard not write a handwritten note about an escape Sonderkommando crematorium?
Yeah.
Fact is, he didn't know the administrative terms for things, but when we look at the actual administrative terms used in Auschwitz, this particular team of inmates working in the crematoriums wasn't called Sonderkommandos officially. So, now the next step, that was the persuasive lie, which we will see over and over again when something with Sonder comes up in a document, the Auschwitz scholars at the museum directly scream, oh, here, evidence. And that's just not true. The next thing we have to talk about are the so-called bunkers. Going back, I mentioned that already, talking about the three monographs that that Karl Martogno published about the early history of the claimed extermination of the Jews. There are three stages to this alleged earlier history. The first one is the first experimental gassing. We don't deal with that here. There's the cover of the book that Karl Martogno published about that. The second is the gassing and the converted morgue of Crematorium 1. We've covered that in the first part. Here is the monograph that Karl Martogno has written about that. And the last one is gassings and the so-called two bunkers of Auschwitz. And that is to be treated now in some detail in this section. Next step. The bunkers. Next step. What mainstream historiography claims about is that in the first half of 1942, two old farmhouses near the Birkenau camp were converted into makeshift homicidal gas chambers. Today, they're usually referred to as Bunker 1 and Bunker 2, even though the early witness statements never used that term. That was kind of agreed upon ex post facto. Next up. You see here an image, actually, that shows, again, David O'Leary, the one witness who has made a lot of atrocity drawings about what's claimed to have happened. That is his depiction of what one of the bunkers, Bunker 2, is supposed to have looked like. In the foreground, you see some inmate digging a mass grave for the victims later. That's the claim. At these bunkers.
The title of that room, if you go back, Chance, just, yeah.
Desinfektion.
Yeah, just, I mean, that would be for delousing, wouldn't it?
Desinfection, yes. I mean, the mainstream historiography says that was meant to deceive inmates in believing they're going just to take a shower and be disinfected.
Isn't that convenient?
Yeah. Well, the very early history of claims about the bunkers actually shows that the way it was described in the very early history makes them sound like descriptions of the very first delousing chambers that were built at Auschwitz. Yeah. We'll come to that later. Yeah. And that's probably where the propaganda story originates.
They just ran it backwards to the earliest attempts to delouse.
Right, and they had signs on it for delousing. So there is also every rumor has a kernel of truth in it.
Who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes?
Anyway, at these bunkers, so these inmates are called Sonderkommando 1 and 2, for Bunker 1 and 2, had to drag out the corpses of the murdered and either bury them in mass graves or later burn them on pyres. Now, interestingly, I have another picture here drawn by another witness, and you can see that what he thinks the bunker looked like is completely different, and that points to the fact that all the evidence we have about this is based on eyewitness accounts, and they're completely contradictory. Next slide. Making a story out of it that's consistent is extremely difficult, and that's what Karl Martogno has done with his third book, Debunking the Bunkers of Auschwitz. Next slide. He shows in there that, no, not slide, next animation, yeah, thank you, that the witness statements, as I already mentioned, are extremely contradictory and at times technically absurd and even impossible. There actually do not exist any documents proving that the structures, if they existed at all, were ever used for anything. The next step. And I don't know everything off the top. Oh, yeah. Air photos ultimately debunked claims about open air incineration infernos claimed for the summer of 1944. Martogno already covers that issue in his books about the bunkers. But there's actually a separate monograph that we have in the series that reproduces a lot of air photos made over Auschwitz and other sites of claimed exterminations and mass murders that shows what was and what was not going on. And with these books, pretty much the claims about what has happened at the bunkers is debunked already. Coming to more specific analysis of the documents presented by the Auschwitz museums, first of all, omissions and misrepresentations. There are many documents, of course, as I mentioned, that referred actually to Sonderkommando, Sonderaktion, Sondermaßnahme, Special Measure, Special Operation, Special Units, and so forth. And as I mentioned, Zetkiewicz and his colleagues always claim that these documents referred to extermination activities at the Lucerne bunkers. Some of these documents, however, either state clearly or the context makes it clear that these Sunder commanders were in charge of sorting, disinfecting, and warehousing inmate property. For instance, Zetkiewicz's document number 12 requests to increase the number of inmates working at the Sunder commander, but it lists as the requesting department the administration of inmate property. So that's exactly the ones that we're dealing with, all the clothes and so forth that needed to be stored, warehoused. Zetkiewicz passes over that in complete silence. Document 55 of similar things, two guards are being requested again by the administration of inmate property, also ignored by Zetkiewicz. He just says, well, it's under commander, therefore it must be murder. Next one, his document 25 lists is a list of existing barracks, and it lists three barracks for personal effects for special treatment. That's another one of those buzzwords. And Zetkiewicz instantly said, oh, that is three barracks for undressing at Bunker 1 at Birkenau. But no, it says to store personal effects, and it says it's located at the Auschwitz main camp. It's not even at the proper place. So he completely misrepresents in the actual contents of that document.
Some evidence is so blatantly refuting of the thesis being propagated that if you don't distort it, your cause is lost.
Right. They have to. I mean, they...
Yeah.
He would be out of a job if the thing collapses. You know, who wants to go to Auschwitz if there was no gas chamber?
That's right.
So, next step. Document number 31, again, a list of buildings used to the for the storage of personal effects. So it's, again, these dead hundreds of thousands of people coming in. They need to store their clothes. They put them in warehouses, including three horse stable barracks, each for Sunder Commander 1 and 2. And Zetkiewicz, again, turns those storage barracks into undressing huts for gas chambers. Now, there's nothing in the document that supports it, but that's what he does. Next slide. Mistranslations. If you want to do Holocaust studies, you need to be pretty good at German, or else you're going to fail because the documentation about that topic for the main part is in German. Their document 11 contains a buzzword, 19 Brennstellen, which they translate to literally as 19 burning sites. Now, if you always translate a foreign language literally, you're going to end up with some surprise, and that's the next animation step, because that's not what it is. You can't translate
it. It's like machine translation, Germar.
Yeah. Whatever they did there. So next step, please. They conclude from that this actually referred to the cremation of corpses murdered in the gas chambers that were put in mass graves and they were now exhumed. The problem number one with that is that not even the most extreme witness account has ever claimed that there were anywhere near 19 open-air cremation sites at Auschwitz. Problem number two with that is that the fact that this work sheet actually is about electrical work performed by the inmate electricians should have alerted Zetkiewicz and his colleague that Brennstein is a German technical term referring in general to a point for connecting light fixtures or other electrical loads. That's a technical term. Nothing to do with cremation sites. So another one, mistranslation. There's another one in this document number 35 contains a buzzword, bei den Ausweich Bunkern. You have the word bunker in there, and that, of course, made him jump here directly to the conclusion. They mistranslated first as reserve bunkers, writing then, next step, please, that this is a request for permission to erect three stable-type barracks at Bunker 2, referred to here as reserve bunker. So they turn that Ausweich bunker into the gassing bunker. Next step, there are a number of problems here, too. The first one is, and I need to read it myself.
Yeah, there's a delay between pressing the button and showing.
Going up at our end, yes, yeah. Unfortunately. So there they are. Okay. So the German word is bei den Ausweich Bunkern. It's plural. It's a plural word and it's not a singular. And nobody ever has claimed that there were several gassing bunkers at any one site. So that's already the first problem. Second is bunker is actually a German term which can mean either a storage facility for bulk items like coal, potato, and grain. There's actually a document in the Auschwitz archives that refers to potato bunkers. Or it is an Erechter. That is just the common term in German for anything Erechter. It's called Bunker. That's everybody knows that. And there were lots of Erechters in Auschwitz starting in 1943, 1944. Or sometimes it's used in the vernacular for a prison. It never has anything to do with homicidal activities. A third problem is Ausweichen does not mean reserve, as Dave replaced it, but to get out of the way of something, to evade. So next step. So what that was probably simply referring to is an air raid shelter that was built in the camp's perimeter. There were actually a number of documents showing that for the SS personnel that was guarding the camp, they had made little escape bunkers where they could just escape in if they happened to come get involved in some Allied air attack. Next mistranslation. Document number 52 contains the word Sackkalk, and they claim that was lime used as a disinfectant when burying the bodies of those that gas chamber victims put in mass graves. I have the document here. Next animation step. There are a number of problems again with that. First, Sackkalk is the German technical term for bagged lime. It's not a disinfectant. That would have been chlorkalk, chlorinated lime, but it's actually a technical term for building material used to make plaster and mortar together with cement. And in fact, the same document, just the line on top, lists cement, 300 kilograms cement, together with the Sackkalk, which shows they were using cement and lime to make mortar. The next
one. You had to go out of your way to take that out of context, given that it's connected to cement.
The next. This is correct. The next one, underneath that is another entry of 1,000 kilograms of cement only without lime, which is used to make cement mortar or even concrete. And that was delivered in July, several months later, even though at that time both bunkers are supposed to have been operational, no construction going on. So what would the Sonderkommando have done with a metric ton of cement at a place where no construction was going on? And finally, as a matter of fact, the document says, in the next step we see that that was actually requested and delivered to BW4, which is an abbreviation for the construction project 4, which were 4 barracks for home economy. So they were being built there. They were being building barracks for home economy to run the camp, and that's where it was delivered for. It was completely misrepresented. So the last mistranslation I have here concerns document number 8, which contains the words Einmauern der Tür in der Gaskammer, walling in of the door in the gas chamber, which they translate as installation of doors as at the second gas chamber. So door turned into doors, the turned into second, and that second then they turned into bunker 2. Now, the interesting thing is that the abbreviation for second in Polish is D dot. So they screwed up there by thinking Polish, but it is German, and D dot in German is just der, which is the definite article, the. Fact is, the only type of gas chamber mentioned in the documents, and that's, oh, yeah, can we have that back? I need that. Is actually our delousing chambers. And at that very time when that document is placed historically, the big delousing chambers at Auschwitz were being constructed, and at that time they were about to be finished, so putting doors into this gas chamber there was perfectly sensible. If you press the next step, it enlarges it. I have put a red rectangle around it, the German term there, Gaskammer. The only context we ever find in the German documents of Auschwitz where the term Gaskammer appears in this is in the context of delousing activities, because Gaskammer was the official term for a delousing chamber or disinfestation chamber that uses gas.
And we appear to have swinging doors here once again.
No, they're double doors. They don't swing through, but they're double doors. And yeah, that's easy. Of course, if you have big racks with clothes that you want to move into that chamber, you want to have a wide door. So that is
obviously unsuitable for a gas chamber.
That's right. So they are two complete misrepresentation of what the document says by mistranslating it, by being either incompetent or malicious. There's the last picture showing me in front of this delousing wing of that delousing gas chamber, taking samples back in 1991, the activity that got me in trouble in the first place. You see the blue stains at the wall, which is the result of exposing walls to massive amounts of Zyklon B, of hydrogen cyanide, the active component in Zyklon B, which reacts with rust in the wall to form that blue pigment. And it's, of course, there to this day, so it's kind of indestructible once it has developed in the wall. So next step, please.
You had a bit more hair in those days.
Well, I like to shave it off completely because it's easier to maintain. So both homicidal gassing bunkers are said to have operated already at the time of the document, so they must have had their doors already. You can't gas people without a door already being set up. So it's also anachronistic to claim that this document has anything to do with the gas chamber unless they change the chronology that they have agreed upon in earlier decades. Next step. This should be the next slide. The Auschwitz time paradox. And that is, briefly go through a number of documents here. If you go to the next step, a lot of these documents that, Setkevich and his colleagues take mention, Sonder, the preface Sonder in some context, and they all want to force it somehow into the claims of extermination of the Jews, which leads to a chronology full of contradictions and anachronisms, and I'll show a few examples of that. I make up with an extermination step a timeline here spanning from the beginning of 1942 up to late 1944. And at the bottom, we'll display step by step the pivotal points in the claimed extermination of the Jews. The first one is Bunker 1 goes into operation. That's said to have happened on the 20th of March together with its two undressing barracks. The next step is the operation, the setup of Bunker 2, the second claimed homicidal gas chamber in this converted farmhouse on the 30th of June with its undressing huts. The next step is Himmler visits the camp and orders that no more mass graves are to be set up, but the corpses are supposed to be burned from now on. And due to that order, it is said that Commandant Hirsch, with some colleagues, went to the Shamlo camp because there was a guy who allegedly knew how to do open-air cremations. He went on the 16th of September. There was actually some traveling going on for some investigation, but the background is more difficult. I don't go into that right now. On the 23rd, based on Hirsch's testimony, at the end of the summer of 42, exhumations of the mass graves are supposed to happen, and then victims are said to have been burned on pyres later in pit cremations. The next step concerns the new crematories, which were built and went operational between March 13th and April 3rd. At least three of them, four were built. The fourth came operational in June only. Because of them being operational with bigger gas chambers with a lot of good cremation capacity, the bunkers 1 and 2 are supposed to have been retired, with Bunker 1 being completely abolished, razed, and every trace removed, everything around it. Actually, a big sewage treatment plant was built then in this place, so there wasn't even room for it anymore. And Bunker 2 was only retired. However, retired means it was reactivated again in mid-May of 1944, when the claimed extermination of the Hungarian Jews is supposed to have started. So that bunker was supposed to have reactivated. Now, these are dates we need to keep in mind that established historiography has agreed upon one way or another. Whether that's always well-founded or not is a different issue, but we just take it as the tenet they have, and which Setkevich has to live with to force his document into it. And now we go into the second step of the animation. On top of it, with yellow little yellow marks pointing to the dates of events that they claim prove extermination. We have already now discussed just before the door that was walled in at Bunker 2. See, Bunker 2 is said to have been operational in June 30th, but at July 8th, they started building in the walls, the doors. Well, that can't have been. They must have already been in there, or that couldn't have worked. Next step, a similar nonsensical claim. 500 inmates were assigned to a special unit. They claim, well, that's because they were preparing to burn, were preparing the burning pits, when in fact they didn't even know how to do it yet. They were traveling to Shamlo and trying to find out how to do it only in September. Next step, similarly anachronistic, the ludicrous mistranslation of this 19 burning sites. Setting up the burning site with floodlights in end of August, when they didn't even know what they were doing, and allegedly tried to find out only in September. Same thing, a couple of weeks later, getting a few trucks of firewood for the upcoming cremation, when in fact they didn't even know yet what they were going to do because they were yet to go on that trip apart. There's only very few documentation about firewood, and the few trucks to burn hundreds of thousands of victims is not going to be enough. Next document, on the 9th of July, 1943, there is a document about rerouting a cable to a Sonderkommando 2. They interpret it as to going to Bunker 2, but at that time, Bunker 2 was retired. There was nothing going on, and nobody would have rewired or refurbished anything at a building that wasn't used and was retired, so that doesn't make sense either. Next step. Remodeling existing houses and setting up three barracks is the original document. They make out of it remodeling Bunker 1 and 2 and getting more undressing barracks. Bunker 1 didn't even exist. It was razed. Now, how can you claim that a document talking about a Sonderkommando 1 getting a certain remodeled building has anything to do with Bunker 1 if Bunker 1 was gone? So it makes no sense at all. Obviously, there was some difference on the commander, a close sortings on the commander, actually. Then 18th, that's the only document in the whole documentation that actually talks about a Bunker 1. And they claim removing a wire from Bunker 1, that's what the document is about. And it can't be because Bunker 1 was raised a year ago and the whole area has been occupied by a huge wastewater treatment plant, there could not have been a wire going to it anymore. It was actually probably...
They just got very, very sloppy, Germar. Yeah. Very sloppy in doing this.
That's right. So Bunker 1, that was probably just an air shelter or a storage facility. That's what the actual German term bunker means. Next one. We get to a series of undressing huts, and that's nice because everywhere when barracks for clothes, for storing of clothes is brought up in some document for a Sonderkommando, which was closed Sonderkommando, actually closed sorting and disinfesting and storing, they say it's an undressing hut actually for the bunker here. Allegedly, May 2nd, an undressing hut is being built at Bunker 1, actually several of them, too. But this place is supposed to have been operational for 2 months and is supposed to have had it already. So it makes no sense to build additional undressing huts or to operate the place without undressing huts. Next one is two huts at Bunker 1, Bunker 2 missing. Same here. In mid-July 1942, Bunker 2 is supposed to have been operational already. So how can there be stuff missing? Is it already operating? Then we have one in early February 1944. Remove three huts from Bunker 1. Cannot be. Bunker 1 and his huts were gone, and the place was occupied by a treatment plant, wastewater treatment plant. Actually, the document says they were storage huts. But they completely misrepresent that. Next one. Then again, toward the extermination of the Hungarian Jews, Bunker 2 is supposed to have gotten operational again, and then there are several documents talking about building barracks for Sonderkommando. And they interpreted, well, that's for Bunker 2. But they say, these documents say it's about three huts, and they are not finished. And the next step actually shows they were talking about finishing these huts into August and September, and they were still not ready. And that extermination action is long since gone. And by the way, air photos show that close to the place where that extermination is going on, A, there were erected only two huts, not three, and B, you can see that no open air cremations were going on, so the claimed extermination didn't happen there. Next step. And that's the last one I have here. That's Christmas of 1943. Request to return the field railway from Sonderkommando 1, which they interpret as Bunker 1. But Bunker 1 was gone, and around it everything else, because it was occupied by something else. There could not have been a field railway anymore. It makes no sense. So that's a staccato of nonsense they've produced, anachronistic nonsense, because they have to force every document that says Sonderkommando into their narrative, but it just doesn't fit. And they have to represent also what the documents actually say. It's about storing inmate property, or it's about other things. Or the context shows that it is actually about sanitary issues and about health issues and so forth.
The time paradox alone is a devastating indictment, Germar.
Yes.
Devastating. Devastating.
This is only actually the tip of the iceberg. Carlo Macchiagna goes into many more examples and proves much more thoroughly that all this, what they are, for many more reasons, what they are saying cannot be, it doesn't fit, it's complete nonsense.
So he must be one of the leading students of Holocaust mythology in the world today.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we are glad that so far Italy has not introduced any Holocaust denial laws, because he is the only person in Italy is actually involved in that kind of studies, and they don't pass a law just for one person. And we can get his valuable research and translate it in other languages and,
excellent.
This way get the news out. So the next slide, has the tip of the mendacity, things that cannot be explained with lack of competence or lack of knowledge. Document 3 from the 19th of July 1941 says that a draft for a delousing facility with hydrogen cyanide system is being revised. So I stay with that for the first entry for a moment. So it says we are building a facility that is supposed to save inmates' lives. It is about to save inmates' lives, and the Setkiewicz and his colleagues makes out of it, while the SS disinfectors are now being instructed how to operate these hydrogen and cyanide systems so that later on they can be assigned to operate homicidal gas chambers. Out of nothing. It's not in the document. It's nowhere in the context. They just interpret it because they have to get to that conclusion somehow, and they just make it out of hot air. Okay, next step. So they turn the truth upside down. This document is about saving inmate lives, and they claim it's about preparing mass murder. Document 64 of 4th November 1944, it's about a construction project, POW camp, implementation of special treatment. This whole document proves that the term special treatment at that point in time for Auschwitz had the meaning of encompassing the entire operation of the camp, including all the Jews coming in. Concentration camps were not initially meant to deal with mass deportation and treatment of Jews. This was a new situation. Jews were deported from all Europe there. That was a special operation, special treatment. And then the actual list of construction projects of buildings that were to be erected in Birkenau during that time, in Auschwitz-Birkenau, there's only one building in the whole list that has all kinds of things like disinfestation, crematories, a butcher and kitchen barracks and. There's only one actual document that expressly states for special treatment. And again, that building is delousing facility for special treatment. There's another building that's delousing facility for the guard detail. So they were separating delousing for the guard people and delousing for the inmates, the Jews, the ones that are undergoing special treatment. They are not going undergoing special treatment in terms of mass murder, but them having been sent to camps is the special treatment, and then they are being subjected to hygienic measures to make sure they survive. But Setkiewicz make out of it, well, special treatment operation is being implemented there, meaning genocide. And that's the opposite of what the document says. It says, delousing, we're saving your lives. Document 67, 7th of January, 1943. Massive amounts, in the next document we can put into the same slot. Massive amounts of Jews were being deported in early 1943 to Auschwitz. And there are two documents that are listed here that expressively say, we need to get prepared for these people. We need to get accommodation. We get in the second example says we are going to have 47,000 Jews coming in. We need to accommodate them. We need to get those accommodations built. And we have problems. We need 6 dump trucks to get that massive construction project underway. Setkiewicz make out of it, well, that might have been in connection with preparation to deport and exterminate Jews from Greece. No, the document says deport and accommodate the Jews. And to build this is what it's about, to build all the facilities to accommodate all of them. The document 67 before, the same thing. they need to get heating stoves to build inmate to put up in the inmate huts in order to accommodate the announced transports, not to kill them. But Zetkevich make out of it. Well,
I think it's very clear.
Yeah, they are building
about how they've had to pervert language and distort and change a historical sequence to put together the fabricated narrative of these camps being extermination centers.
Right. The last one, which is mendacious, is a document that actually has a speech that Commandant Hirsch held, gave in on the 22nd of May of 1943, where he says, was going through the problems that the camp had to solve, and he says there, that's the central phrase in the document, the solution of the Jewish question, which required creating the means to accommodate 60,000 prisoners at first, which increased to 100,000 within a short period of time. That's the solution of the Jewish problems, getting them all out of Europe and accommodate them. And Zetkevich and his colleagues turn that in, this operation to solve the Jewish question by genocide is currently underway there. They don't say by genocide, but the whole book is the context. The operation of the Jewish question is the genocide, is the mass murder, and that was actually going on there, and that's what this document proved. No, it proves creating the means to accommodate them. There's nothing in there about genocide, about murder whatsoever. So
is the phrase the solution of the Jewish question even in the original?
Yeah, that's in the original.
What does it mean?
In that context, it obviously means they were accommodating them, trying to get them to work for the war effort and so forth.
Sure.
So next slide. That's my conclusion. We're at the end with my presentation. We can, if we have still time, then talk about some questions that may have come up. Next slide. To summarize it up, none of the 74 documents have any relation to the alleged extermination of the Jews whatsoever. There's nothing in there that has anything to do with homicide. In order to create that fictitious relation, however, the authors have to, next one, systematically misrepresent and distort the documents. They ignore their meanings and their context. They provide totally inconsistent and fanciful interpretations, and they show a remarkable superficiality and historiographical inaptitude. Their most severe crime against science, against scholarship, however, is a fundamental deception according to which there existed merely one kind of Sonderkommando at Auschwitz, that is to say, a homicidal one. Having said all this, the head of the Auschwitz Museum depicted again on the right, that is Piotr Zetkevich, and I've turned that with the next animation step to something else. It's not Piotr Zetkevich. I turned him into Pinocchio Zetkevich.
Yes.
Man, yes. The nose.
Yes, yes. His nose is growing.
Right. So this is a summary of the book that we are just in the process of releasing. Right now you can get it on Amazon.com. Other country Amazon outlets are still in the process of getting it up. It is listed, but to get it through the print-on-demand process takes a couple of days sometimes. And I have given a link here. We have a dedicated web page, holocausthandbooks.com, that has not just that book, but all the other books of the series. Most of them are actually available as free downloads, PDF or Kindle. Some of them are not, where we have contracts with authors that depend on their royalty. We can't just give it all away for free. But Carlo Martoni always makes available all his stuff for free because we have faced a lot of censorship, and putting an additional hurdle on it by requiring people to identify themselves and to give money to us or to anyone else is too much to ask. A lot of scholars that are in the mainstream have a lot to lose. They don't even want to put their name in the context of any purchase of literature that they can get in trouble for. But if they can then download it for free anonymously on the internet, that's how I know that a lot of scholars actually do that. They are aware of it. They may not talk about it, but we are making an impact, and some of these historians actually come off the woodwork and indicate that they have knowledge about it and appreciate what we are doing. And that's, of course, we an incentive for us to keep going, because we know that we are being recognized, if only behind closed doors, but that's better than nothing. It's a start.
Well, your work is so thorough, meticulous, and detailed. It seems to me, as Popper observed, the more detailed and specific an hypothesis, the easier it can be subjected to falsification if it is false. On the other hand, you know, you have substantiated your claims in such a thoroughgoing fashion, I cannot imagine how anyone would ever attempt to rise to the occasion to refute any of the works in your series. I mean, it's just appalling to me, Germar, that we continue to live in a world in which denying the Holocaust is a crime in some nations. I mean, that is just stupefying. It reflects the significance of the adage that if you want to know by whom you are ruled, ask who you are not allowed to criticize.
Correct. I mean, just talking about what it means, denying the Holocaust, people think when somebody denies the Holocaust, they deny the fact of the Jews having been persecuted, the Jews having been deported, put into forced labor camps, ghettos, have been put into situations where they were subjected to conditions as a result of which tens or hundreds of thousands of them died. This is not denied at all. We're talking here about premeditated policy of mass extermination by conveyor belt industrialized methods, that is to say the chemical slaughterhouses of gas chambers, and that's what's subject to criticism primarily in that series. You're right, the mainstream scholars that try to support the Orthodox claim don't dare to even mention any of these books. We have seen it. On the first page, it says no studies exist that have so far investigated the early history. It's a lie. But it's necessary for them to claim this so that they can hide the fact that it has been investigated and thoroughly investigated, and it's out there. Any book by these people, never. If you go into the bibliography, you don't find the name Matonio in it. He is the author who has all in all published on the Holocaust some, I think he's up to 20 monographs right now, totaling something in 3,000-5,000 pages. I don't even know. Thorough research that is completely unparalleled, and you will not find anyone ever mentioning them. There are a few websites on the internet of some mainstream scholars, not necessarily historians, just aficionados of the Orthodox narrative that try to refute. And they sometimes contribute worthwhile criticism where revisionists make mistake and need to revise their own position. It's all legitimate, but they're also throwing a lot of mud around. But when it comes to published, peer-reviewed, printed books and material of that kind, our stuff is, which is so superior by quantity and quality to the mainstream stuff, is completely neglected, muted, as if it never existed. Because they can't stand up to it. They can't face that criticism. It would collapse.
Are you able to get any reviews from Kirkus, Publishers Weekly, or any of the other standard, well-known entities that review books? They won't do it. What about historical societies? You know, there must be, or the History of Science Society. You know, it's just dumbfounding to me how they become ignorant. Blind, deaf, they can't even acknowledge the existence of work of this kind.
I've tried a number of times to actually submit ads. I have at times sent them review copies, but it never leads to anything. But then I could, of course, in their publications, print ads for the books we have for the series. I've done that once, and maybe we'll try it again. What that led to, I can't remember which. The one was... too long ago. In one case, I know it's World War II History. It's the biggest history magazine in the United States. We submitted an ad, and that was then when they figured out what it's about. It was not only rejected, but we got banned to ever submit ads again.
Really?
In the other case, it was an academic journal. I can't remember anymore what the situation was. We submitted an ad, and by mistake, they accepted it. It was a back cover ad. So it was very prominent on top of it. And some person in their editorial offices realized when it was printed was on the back cover. They pubbed the whole issue. Didn't send out a single copy to anyone. Before they mailed it out, they pubbed the whole issue, reprinted it, delayed the whole process to have that ad removed, and we got banned there too. So almost made it, but only almost.
Grimmar, this is so shameful. Absolutely. This is so disrespectful of historiography, of research, of truth. I mean, it's just simply appalling to me.
That shows you how powerful this taboo is. I've read that 95% of the populace, of people of all walks of life, no matter how well educated, are incapable of thinking outside the box if it is about normal issues. However, if we are talking about a taboo, and this is one of the, if not the biggest taboo in the Western world to talk about these issues, we're talking about a taboo where societal or even legal reinforcement of a certain view is so massive, then you can count on 99% or even more of people not capable and not willing to think outside the box. And that's what you have to do in this context. I mean, there's such a bad stigma attached to the whole thing.
Repeat the percentage you're unwilling to think outside the box or incapable is how high?
Well, for normal issues, it's about 95%.
95% just for normal issues?
Yeah.
And for something controversial like this, it must be 99?
That's right. Now, that's the numbers we see. I mean, I know how many scholars there are in the United States, and I know how many actually approach us and they talk to us. So that's not even 1%. It's a fraction of 1%. So if you tenfold that, you may reach a 1%, and these are the people who are behind the scene observing it with interest but don't dare speak out because of the persecutions that are possible.
Grimmar, you're doing an absolutely brilliant job. I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. I think your slide set is fantastic. I think the quality of your work is completely superior. And you just have my unqualified admiration and support.
Thank you for that. I know you've approached me in the past trying to get my advice on this or that question on the Holocaust research, and I have sometimes been a little bit curt with what my response was because I have the plate full with all the things I'm involved in. And for me, it's always a problem. I want to help people and give them the information, but I can also, the listeners the viewers who see that, only ask them to go to these resources that are out there, the Holocaust Handbook series. Most of it is for free. And I'm sure you find almost all the answers you can look for in those books. And those questions that are not answered, there are probably no answers yet. And you may want to find out your own answers and contribute.
Sensational. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, thanking my special guest, Grimmar Rudolph, for being here, and all of you for watching.
Thank you.
Hi, my name's Gary King, and I've assembled the most formidable JFK team on planet Earth. We've got Dr. James Fetzer, Larry Rivera, who is the number one researcher in the world today when it comes to new research, and we've got Don Fox, who's not afraid to look a little bit deeper than anyone else. So if you're interested in what happened to the 35th President of the United States, then I invite you to our show. It's called The New JFK Show. And it's on YouTube. Go to Gary King YouTube channel, and we've got over 90 shows archived for you there. So if you really want to know the truth, and knowing that over 9 out of 10 researchers are working the other side of the street in a sea of disinformation, I pledge to you the truth about JFK. Go to Gary King YouTube channel and find out your true history.